I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Does today's CIA have a secret connection to the leadership of Hamas that could one day make a difference in the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis? Once upon a time, there was such a connection. Today, we hear the story of Robert Ames, the CIA's top Middle East intelligence officer in the 1970s and 80s, a skilled case agent who spoke fluent Arabic. Ames helped the Carter administration prepare for the Camp David negotiations. He briefed President Ronald Reagan on Middle East affairs. Although he dealt regularly with Israel's Mossad intelligence service, Ames was an Arab sympathizer who befriended the PLO leader at the top of the Mossad hit list for the murder of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics. The good spy and the bad guys on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day on WYPR, WYPF, WYPO, and streaming online through WYPR.org. On the ground, spying is an unsavory business. It often means persuading people to betray their countries or running covert operations that can fail with astonishing consequences. But CIA case officers have another function that's rarely reported: opening backdoor channels to hostile governments or terrorist groups that diplomats can't talk to. This means talking to the bad guys, the enemies of your allies, in the hope of brokering peace, or at least creating some stability. Our guest this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Kai Bird, says the CIA has always dealt with bad guys, and it's essential that the agency keep doing so because bad guys know a lot more about what other bad guys are doing than good guys ever will. Kai Bird has written a true life account of a CIA agent, a legendary CIA agent few Americans have ever heard of. Robert Ames was an Arabist who skillfully navigated the moral ambiguities of the Middle East for two decades before he died in the 1983 truck bombing of the American embassy in Beirut. The product of a blue-collar family from Philadelphia who joined the CIA after learning Arabic in the army, Robert Ames was fascinated by the Arab language and nuances of the region's many cultures. He eventually rose to director of Near East Intelligence. Although many regarded Robert Ames as pro-Arab, Kai Bird portrays him as a skilled operative and the closest thing to an honest broker in a shadowy, dishonest world. Robert Ames developed sources based on friendship, empathy, and a willingness to listen. His biggest fish and most problematic friend was Ali Hassan Salameh, Yasser Arafat's executive officer in the Palestine Liberation Organization, then branded as a terrorist organization. Their relationship was central to the mosaic Kai Bird has constructed of an intelligence world where every color is gray. Kai Bird is a distinguished historian who won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for co-authoring American Prometheus, a biography of atomic scientist Robert Oppenheimer. His book, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, is a memoir of growing up in a Foreign Service household. Kai Bird's list of fellowships and awards could fill another book, and we're happy to have him here to discuss his latest. It's called The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, available from Crown Press. So, Kai Bird, we want to welcome you to Baltimore, the Midday Show here on WYPR. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan. It's very good to be here.
I note there that your father was a Foreign Service officer. And at the very beginning, I'd just like to, for our listeners to know, that you had at least a nodding acquaintance with the subject of your book when you were a kid, Robert Ames.
Yes, that's right. When I was 11, 12, 13 years old, he was our next-door neighbor in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. He lived right across the street. This was his first posting as a young CIA officer in his late 20s. And so I have vivid memories of him. He was, you know, a strikingly tall, handsome, all-American-looking guy who loved to play basketball with the local Marines who were guarding the consulate compound. And And I remember his lovely wife, who looked like Lee Volman, beautiful blonde, blue-eyed woman. And he had two young kids at the time. And so, yes, I knew him.
And he had a bunch of kids, six kids. And his wife, later, obviously his widow, when you approached her, did she remember you?
She did. She did indeed. I sent her an email out of the blue. I hadn't seen her in, 40 years. And she almost didn't answer the email, but I headlined it Dahran Memories, and she was curious and opened it up and remembered who I was and remembered my parents. And she began to, talk. She had never talked to a reporter before or historian about her husband, who had died, as you mentioned, in the 1983 truck bomb attack on the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And she was still very scarred and wounded by this whole history.
How did you come to know that Robert Ames was a legend? And I want to say at this point, when I hear the Ames name associated with the CIA, like a lot of Americans, I probably respond by saying, oh, Aldrich Ames, is that what that book is about? Because exactly. We know about Aldrich Ames, who went to prison for selling, he sold out to Russia, right? The Soviet Union.
Right. Yeah, he was a spy for money for the Russians, although he was a CIA officer. No, this is not Aldrich Ames. This is Robert Ames or Bob Ames. And Aldrich Ames was the bad spy. And as my book's title says, Robert Ames was the good spy. And he was a very good spy. He was good in the way, he was just a decent man, but he was also very good at his work. And good meaning that he knew how to get people to talk. He was a good listener. He knew how to acquire sources, and that's a very basic talent for a spy.
How did you come to know that he was considered a legend in the CIA? The CIA didn't exactly help you with this book. It sounds to me like a lot of his old colleagues helped you with this book and wanted people to know about him.
Exactly. Well, when I knew him as a child, as a next-door neighbor, I didn't realize he was a CIA officer. I thought he was a Foreign Service officer like my father. But years later, when I became a journalist, my father confided in me that he knew that Bob was actually a CIA officer. And then I read about his death in 1983, and that was kind of jarring, also because he died in the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, where, as it happened, I actually, when I was 10 years old, I lived in that building in an apartment in the embassy with my family. And so, that struck home very close. So I became curious about it and sort of filed his death away and came back to it, He died in 83, and I began to work on this book in 2010. I went to the CIA, and I said, I think he has an interesting story. He's a hero. I understand. Please help me. Let me talk to one of your in-house historians and check basic facts. And the public affairs officer nodded his head and said he thought that might be a good idea, but nothing ever happened. But eventually I did, as you mentioned, I did get more than 40 intelligence officers retired to talk to me, and eventually 15 of them actually went on the record. They decided that, they wanted their own name, their true names to be used, that, yes, they were telling me secrets, but they were 30- and 40-year-old secrets, and they wanted this story to be told about this legendary CIA officer who was lauded inside the agency, but he's still virtually unknown to most Americans.
Kai Bird, for many years after its founding, the Central Intelligence Agency had the reputation as being the province of Ivy Leaguers from elite backgrounds, much as, Britain's spy service recruited from Oxford and Cambridge. But we have to talk about Robert Ames here because he came from an entirely different background, and he had quite a different approach to recruiting assets, so to speak, as they call them in the CIA. First, let's talk about his background. I mentioned his blue-collar background in the Philly area.
Right. Yeah, he was the son of a steelworker. Not at all blue blood, not at all Boston Brahmin or Yale or Harvard or Skull and Bones. Mm-hmm. He grew up in a very working class neighborhood in North Philadelphia. He loved to play basketball as a teenager. He was a lifeguard on the Jersey Shore. He was the only member of his family who ever went to college on a basketball scholarship. And he was a real his team, LaSalle College, won the national basketball championship that year in 1954. He was, you know, really just an all-American kind of kid with a very ordinary middle-class, working-class kind of background. But he was drafted into the U.S. Army, and they sent him to Ethiopia, to Kagnu Station, where he sort of got his first taste of the world of intelligence, intercept intelligence in this case. And he first heard Arabics being spoken in the streets. And he liked the language, he liked the cadence of it, and he began to learn the language on his own. Extraordinary. And then when he got out of the Army, he had a job in an insurance company for a bit and then applied to the CIA, and they took him in 1960.
He became a case agent. What exactly is a case agent?
Well, actually, he was a case officer. An agent is someone who a case officer recruits.
Okay.
But he was an officer, and that meant that he was put through rigorous training at the farm in Northern Virginia, given paramilitary training, which he never really had to use. But he, you know, knew how to fire a gun, and he at times during his career had to, like a James Bond, carry a pistol in his belt, but he never used it. He hated guns. And then they put him through a course to sort of give him the basics of how to recruit people, what the steps are. And the whole point of a clandestine CIA officer is to recruit agents who are paid. Who sign a contract and are, you know, take money to, and therefore sort of come under the control of the case officer. And Ames did this, but, you know, it's very hard to do this, as I realized from talking to some of my retired CIA spooks, as they are sometimes known. Very few people are actually recruited. Ames recruited some, but he was... As you've mentioned, he targeted for recruitment a young man named Ali Hassan Salameh, who was Yasser Arafat's virtual intelligence chief and chief bodyguard. And Ames quickly realized that Ali Hassan was not someone who was recruitable. He was too loyal to the Palestinian Revolution, to the cause, but he could be turned into a source, and Ames cultivated this friendship and turned it into a genuine friendship. You know, one of my CIA sources said, well, sometimes, you know, in our business, you have to sup with the devil, but you do so with a very long spoon. Well, Robert Ames actually did it with a very short spoon. He got very close to Ali Hassan Salameh. He, in the mid-70s, he was visiting his apartment, and when he was in Beirut, he'd make a point of dropping by and having dinner in Salameh's home every other night, socializing with his wife and children. And he really got to know this guy.
And he liked this style of recruiting. He couldn't see passing money along and getting a receipt for it, which is what the formal process or the protocol that the other case officers criticized for not doing it properly. For not getting a receipt.
So he
liked this looser style. So he becomes friends with this fellow who is a leader in the Palestine Liberation Organization. And we're going to take a break here and pick up there, Kai Bird, okay? We need to take our first break here on Midday. Kai Bird is our guest, author of The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, a look at the life and the work of this agent of the CIA, a legend within the CIA, not known to many Americans, he became a leading authority on Middle East intelligence, advised the Carter administration, and later President Ronald Reagan. More on this when we get back, a short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with Kai Bird, a distinguished historian and most recently the author of The Good Spy, the life and death of Robert Ames, who spent decades working various difficult posts in the Middle East and ultimately became chief of intelligence for that region of the world. This is the story of a skilled and really dedicated agent who spent his career trying to promote some kind of a dialogue between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization back in the 1970s. And that meant establishing the kind of back-channel communications that were forbidden for diplomats at the time because the PLO was considered a terrorist organization. And I like the way you put this, Kai Bird. I quoted you in the beginning of the show here that this is essential. It's essential that agents of the CIA keep doing this because bad guys know a lot more about what other bad guys are doing than good guys ever will. So when Robert Ames became friends with Salome, establishing a connection with someone who was a leader in the Palestine Liberation Organization, did he do this on his own? Did supervisors at the CIA said, yes, pursue this?
Ah, well, very good question, Dan. Well, initially, no. Ames's purpose was to go out and recruit people of interest who were knowledgeable about what was going on in the streets of Beirut in this case. And the PLO in 1969 was a major player in Lebanon and the region. And yet Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor at the time and later Secretary of State, had promised the Israelis and announced very publicly that no U.S. official would have anything to do with these terrorists. So a diplomat couldn't talk to him. My father, as an Arabist, a foreign service officer, was not allowed to associate with anyone from the PLO. But Ames ran into and befriended a young Lebanese businessman who was, in turn, good friends with Ali Hassan Salame. And he realized that this was a connection. And he cultivated both Mustafa Zain, his sort of informal access agent, although Zain was, again, someone who was not recruitable, never took a dime from the CIA, just thought that the PLO should be talking to the Americans and the Americans should be talking to the PLO. And so it was Zain who set up the initial meeting with Salome in a very sort of cloak and dagger fashion in a cafe, the Strand Cafe off of Rue Hamra in West Beirut. And this led to a series of meetings and safe houses and a friendship eventually. Now, in the course of this, as I said, Ames realized that Salome was someone who could not be recruited. He wouldn't take money. But eventually he did report this back, his contacts with this man, to his boss, Richard Helms, the director of the CIA at the time. And Helms encouraged him to go ahead with this. This is exactly what an agent should be, a CIA officer should be doing.
And was it known at the time about Salome's connections? For instance, Salome's role in the 1972 massacre at the Summer Olympics in Munich.
Well, when the friendship first began, it was in December 1969, so this was long before the Munich tragedy.
Okay.
Was this friendship known? No. It was a secret, even inside the CIA. Very few people knew about this back channel. And it was, a difficult thing to manage in the midst of the chaos and the controversy of what was going on. The Jordanian civil war between the Palestinians and the Jordanians took place in September 1970, and Salome was deeply involved in that. There were, all sorts of terrorist operations against European targets and some American targets during these years. And, the relationship was actually a two-way street, and this is the fascinating thing about it. Ames was trying to turn this friendship into a sort of informal liaison back channel where they could share useful intelligence back and forth. At the same time, Ames was trying to talk Salome into realizing that Palestinian aims were not going to be achieved by the gun. and that they should start acting like a political movement and a party, and that they should realize that a two-state solution and some kind of political compromise with their adversaries in Israel was inevitable. And at the same time, Salome, it was a two-way street. Salome was trying to draw Ames into his orbit, get information from him, and also to get the CIA to talk and have a regular relationship with the PLO. And to eventually, he hoped this would lead to some kind of recognition, which, of course, the Israelis, when they found out about this relationship, this was their worst fear. They feared that Ames talking to Salome would lead to Ames talking to Arafat, which indeed eventually happened, and that that would eventually lead to Arafat, talking to American politicians and standing on the White House lawn. And indeed, that did happen, too.
And it was Robert Ames who believed this could happen and would only happen if they could establish some communication with the PLO. And he saw the channel for that as Salome.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in the course of my interviews, it became very clear that people inside the agency at the time, this is in the, from 69 through the early 70s, they thought this was absolutely essential and a good thing to do. And in retrospect, they all told me they believed that this planted the seeds of the Oslo peace process, that it led to Palestinians talking to Americans, but also Palestinians eventually talking to their adversaries, the Israelis.
Let's talk a little bit more about this relationship. Salome, obviously, this is a very interesting fellow anyway. We should talk about him, his personality, his habits, because he's not, total opposite, because you have Robert Ames, who's a pretty straight-laced fellow with a short haircut, home for dinner every night with the family, versus Salome. So we should talk about this a little bit, but I want to make this point here. Salome could not become an official asset of the CIA, because that would get him in a lot of trouble with his own organization, right?
Oh, yes. If that even became a rumor in Beirut, he could be a dead man.
Right.
There were people gunning for people who were, quote, CIA agents. Salome had to play a very careful role in his relationship with Ames, and it was clandestine. It was entirely a secret.
And I mentioned, I got ahead of the story a little bit by mentioning 1972 in Munich. I wanted to get to that because Salome was high on Mossad's hit list for his part.
Exactly.
For his part in that. Mossad, of course, the intelligence service of Israel. But take a moment here, would you please, Kyber, and tell us a little bit about Salome in contrast to the personality of the subject of your book, Robert Ames.
Well, when they met in 1969, Ames was, in his early 30s, and Salome was in his late 20s, and Salome was a playboy. He was a Palestinian aristocrat. He loved fast cars and drank good red wine, and he liked hanging out with beautiful women in Beirut's nightclubs. He was the total opposite. He loved to of Ames, who was very straight-laced, as you say. Salome loved to dress all in black, and he wore gold chains, and he had his shirt unbuttoned a little bit so you could see his hairy chest. He was married to a beautiful Palestinian woman, but in the mid-70s, he fell in love with a Lebanese beauty queen named Georgina Rizik, who had indeed been crowned Miss Universe in 1971. And so, astonishingly enough, he eventually married this woman, acquiring a, quote, second wife as a Muslim. And just as an aside, shortly before this happened, he told Ames that his prospective new wife wanted to go on a honeymoon to Disneyland, and could Ames arrange this? So he did. He brought Salome and Rizik to America undercover and arranged for them to visit Disneyland in California and also, as it happened, New Orleans, and have a short vacation as well in Hawaii.
At this point, as Americans listening to this, taxpayers may be wondering, well, what did we get out of that at that time? I understand this is all in the course of cultivating the relationship. Right. What was the U.S. getting out of this?
Oh, it was saving lives, first and foremost. Early in this relationship, well, you know, it took a while. They met in 69, but by 1973, after Munich, by the way, where the Israelis believed that Salomé had been involved in the Munich tragedy where 11 Israeli athletes were murdered, although the evidence for this is far more murky than Mossad would have you believe. In any case, by 1973, Ames had negotiated a deal whereby the PLO and Salomé and Arafat promised not to target American officials or citizens, and they began providing protection, security, to the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. And this became extremely important in the midst of the very brutal, bloody Lebanese civil war that began in 1975. So this became, you know, an essential relationship for official Americans, and it saved lives, and it provided intelligence about terrorists who were enemies also of the PLO, people like Abu Nidal, and people who were critical of Arafat for being, quote, a moderate.
Mm-hmm. Moral ambiguity as a way of life. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, the life of this particular CIA officer that you describe in your book. Once Munich happens, I guess we assume, or maybe you have the facts to back it up, that Robert Ames might have known about Salomé's connection to that, or at least Mossad's allegations.
Oh, yes. When Munich happened, it was, you know, Ames thought this was a disaster. Here he was in the midst of trying to cultivate a relationship and to bring the Palestinians in from the cold, so to speak. And then this operation happens and carried out allegedly by the Black September unit of the PLO, which was authorized, as we now know, by Arafat. I found letters that Ames wrote to Mustafa Zain talking about his feelings about Munich. And, you know, it was horrible. He thought that if Salomé was involved, he believed this would, you know, be the end of the relationship. And he thought he had spent a lot of time and effort to try to cultivate this friendship and this back channel, and here the Palestinians go off and before the cameras of the whole world, they murder these 11 innocent Israeli athletes. However, down the road, Ames convinced himself, at least, that Salomé had no personal involvement in that operation. And indeed, I have evidence that Salomé had been put on a leave of absence in the summer of 72 and put on probation for something else by Arafat. And so he was actually not involved in that particular operation. But the Israelis certainly believed he was, and he had been involved in other operations in Europe. You know, he was a man who carried a gun. He was a revolutionary. And they put him on, as you mentioned, they put him on their list very high up of people to be assassinated. And they made numerous attempts and finally did kill him with a car bomb in January 1979.
And Robert Ames had warned him that that could happen.
That's right. Ames, to the very end, was trying to protect this man as a source, as a friend. And he warned him that he understood that the Israelis had reactivated their mission to assassinate him and warned him to take further precautions. He actually sent encrypted communications equipment to try to beef up his security. There was even talk of sending Ali Hassan Salomé a armored car, but that never arrived. And he also, you know, Mossad actually approached Ames directly and asked him, "Is Ali Hassan Salomé your man?" And this these approaches, there were several of them in the summer of 1978, were debated, what should we tell the Israelis? So meetings were held in Langley, the CIA headquarters, to try to figure out what should the response be, and they decided in the end that they couldn't give a response. Hmm. The best response was no response, because Salameh was not their agent, he was not their man. And if they attempted to say that he was, they feared that, and Salameh vigorously protested that he didn't want to be so identified, because he feared that this would again make him a target by his own people back in Beirut. So he was very fatalistic. He said, if the time comes, the time will come, and they'll get me.
Can you talk a little bit before our next break, Kai Bird, about Robert Ames and Israel? Not just Mossad, but his relations generally in that country with officials, yes, of that country, and his approach to Israel, his feelings about Israel and in the Palestinian conflict.
Well, it's certainly true that Robert Ames, as an Arabist who had spent most of his career in the Middle East, was sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinian refugees and their cause and their demands for self-determination. But Ames was he was a very decent guy, and he understood that the world is a complicated place. He understood the complicated history. He immersed himself in the history of the region, reading all sorts of books about it. And as he rose higher and higher in the ranks of the agency, he at one point became national intelligence officer for the Middle East, and that required him in his job to visit Israel twice a year and to have liaison meetings with his counterparts in Mossad. And it's very interesting. I talked to four retired Mossad officers who had known Ames, and they acquired a deep respect for him. They understood that he was, in a sense, an adversary, that he was sympathetic to their adversaries. But they also understood that this was a man who understood the dilemmas of their own security plight, and that he wasn't an ideologue. I tell in the book about a letter that Ames wrote back to his wife Yvonne after visiting the old city and seeing the Jews pray at the Wailing Wall, and he said, to Yvonne, I can understand why this city should never be divided again, and why these people, need to have the right to pray at this one of their holy sites. He was a very, genuine and sympathetic kind of man who understood both sides.
Our guest in this hour of midday is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Kai Bird. His latest book, The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, a true story with many elements of a spy thriller. Robert Ames was the CIA's leading authority on Middle East intelligence in the 1970s and 80s. He died in the car bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut in 1983. He's a legend in the CIA. More about him when we get back. A short break on Midday Friday. Welcome back to Midday. To say that Bob Ames was sympathetic to the Palestinian cause would be an understatement. Kai Bird concludes in his book, The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. I want to go backtrack just a little bit, Kai, to emphasize, the era that we're talking about. The PLO established sometime in the 60s. We're speaking here about the late 60s. Early 70s, into the 70s, and into the early 80s, contact between the American government, American officials, and the PLO was strictly prohibited by executive order because the PLO was listed as a terrorist organization. So even though I established with you that Robert Ames had approval to pursue his relationship with Salameh, did he violate U.S. policy and law? Did other superiors become aware of what he was doing eventually?
Oh, yes. Even Henry Kissinger knew what he was doing.
Okay.
And if you look at Kissinger's own memoirs, he, between the lines, he acknowledges the fact that he knew. He acknowledges that there were contacts in the intelligence realm. But, you know, this is what CIA officers do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true, you know, in 1978, Andrew Young, Jimmy Carter's ambassador to the United Nations, lost his job because he had a casual, accidental meeting with a PLO official in New York City. So what Ames was doing was certainly controversial. But it was clandestine, and it was kept a secret. My sources in the agency today say that it was absolutely essential to not only creating a back channel to the PLO, but to planting the seeds for a peace process.
Let's talk about that. I want to hear more from you on that. So obviously our government was willing to take advantage of this channel, this back channel that Robert Ames had established. So get us to Camp David. What's the influence? How does it connect to Camp David?
Well, this friendship between Ames and Salamé virtually led to the evolution of the PLO's position from a revolutionary organization determined to establish a dismantling of the Israeli state to a position of recognizing that Israel is here to stay. Now, what's astonishing to realize is that Salamé was telling Bob Ames as early as 1973 that Arafat understood that Israel was here to stay. And here we are decades later, and we still don't have a two-state solution. And, of course, it's, you know, the obvious rational solution to this horrible conflict, and we're still not there.
We are still not there. If Robert Ames had lived, because we're going to go over what happened to him, but if he were around today, I don't know if he maybe be retired by now, but had he lived into the 80s and 90s, I mean, are you convinced from your research and reporting, these interviews you did, not only did he plant the seeds for the peace process, but maybe something might have grown from it, something real, something that had lasted?
Well, you're posing what historians call a counterfactual question, and, you know, you can never really know.
Right.
But it is certainly true that for instance, 1982, Bob Ames had then risen to a point where he was director of all analytical intelligence for the Middle East. And in that position, he was the guy to brief Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office. And he also became the ghostwriter for Ronald Reagan's September 1st, 1982 peace initiative. That was the first time where the U.S. government officially laid on the table their own vision for what should happen. And it was a very courageous step forward by Reagan and his Secretary of State, George Shultz. And it, again, was a major step towards the idea of a two-state solution, two people fighting over one piece of land, and so let's divide the land and have these two peoples live as peaceful neighbors under a two-state solution. Ames was killed just a year later, six months later. And so I would argue that, you know, with his death, which shocked Reagan and also shocked his Secretary of State, George Shultz, their courage and their stamina to push this Reagan peace plan sort of waned, and they lost energy in it. And then 6 months after the terrible truck bomb attack that killed 63 people in the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, including 8 CIA officers, including Robert Ames, 6 months later, another truck bomb attack comes in and kills 241 U.S. servicemen in Beirut. And at that point, Reagan gives up, and he withdraws the Marines, and he walks away, and he does nothing to push his Reagan peace initiative. He does nothing to convince the Israelis to honor their commitments from the 1979 Camp David Accords regarding the settlements in the West Bank. And so decades later, we are faced with a position where we're fast running out of time, because facts on the ground are creating a dilemma where, you know, there are so many settlements and settlers, Israeli settlers in the West Bank, that it's going to be very difficult to create a two-state solution.
Yeah. Some of the old hands at the CIA that you interviewed, pretty convinced of Ames' influence in all of this, in laying the groundwork anyway for Camp David, for the Oslo Accords later in the 90s. Are you convinced of it now, having heard it all?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Ames was, you know, an essential sort of catalyst to the whole process. He was trusted. People understood that this was a man who was grounded. He was no ideologue. Someone like George Shultz, when he first got to know him in 1982, he quickly began to rely on him. He called him his Mr. Middle East. Ronald Reagan, who was very impatient with briefings, nevertheless understood that Ames was someone who was real and understood the region. And, you know, he was very, very definitely a catalyst.
It kind of begs the question about what's going on today. Of course, it's hard to know because there's a secret organization, the CIA, the NSA. But, you know, does today's CIA, I ask this question, perhaps it's just rhetorical, Kai Bird, have a secret connection to the leadership of Hamas that could make a difference in the conflict that we see now?
Well, you'd certainly hope so. But my sources are rather skeptical. When Ames died in 1983, you know, there were probably half a dozen clandestine CIA officers who knew the Middle East as well as he did and who could speak the language. On the eve of 9/11, that was also the same number was true, half a dozen. The CIA just hasn't invested in human intelligence. You know, we've heard a lot in recent years about the value of intercept intelligence, the National Security Agency, and listening to our phones and emails and how this is absolutely essential to our national security. When you read The Good Spy, you may have doubts about that, and you'll realize the importance of human relationships, of human intelligence. You cannot get at motivation or an understanding of human intentions simply through wiretaps. You need to have relationships, and that's what Robert Ames was very good at. He understood this part of the world, and he understood our weaknesses as a country in trying to influence it. He was a man of great humility. He understood the region in a way that I think very few CIA officers do today, and that's a real tragedy.
It wasn't just us against them with Robert Ames. I mean, that's sort of my takeaway from it. A man who appreciated nuances and, as you were just beautifully describing, different personalities and different desires of people. I'm just so struck by this briefing that he had with Ronald Reagan, where he was going through some of these nuances, and the president said, but they're all terrorists anyway, right?
That's right.
I mean, you contrast that with the point that Robert Ames is trying to make to the chief executive.
Yeah, no, it's hard to convey the subtleties. And the Middle East is, you know, the world is a complex place, but the Middle East historically, geographically, is a mix of religions and culture and peoples, ethnic origins. So it's a very complicated piece of territory. And, you know, we Americans have done a lot of damage. We have a lot of blood on our hands in this part of the world, and we've wasted. I'm afraid if you one of the other things you'll take away from The Good Spy is that the 1960s and 70s, the American presence in the Middle East was we had a smaller footprint, a gentler footprint. And today we have no empathy, no understanding of the region. We're not considered to be a balanced intermediary. And so it's very hard to see how we can have any influence in this region.
I wanted to just go over a few facts that I found interesting and had questions about before we finish our hour together, Kai Bird. One thing I was curious about is after Ali Hassan Salameh's death, now that was 1979, Robert Ames lived four more years into 1983. Right. Did he have any other, I meant to ask if he had any other contacts in the PLO. Did his relationship with the PLO go anywhere after that?
Yes, the relationships continued. It was not the same because the friendship between Ames and Salameh was, one of trust after a decade. But there were further contacts, and there were, even in 1983, after Ames's death, I've learned since the book came out that there were other CIA officers who tried to have the same kind of back channel, to continue the back channel relationship that Ames had developed over 10 years. And so this continued, but it wasn't as good as what Ames had with Salameh.
And what about the Israelis? Did the Mossad find out about the relationship eventually?
Oh, yes, they did. They found out about it actually pretty early on. They attempted to kill Salameh as early as 1971. They attempted it again in 1973 and instead mistakenly shot and killed a innocent Moroccan waiter in Norway whom they believed had been Salameh. And they then reactivated their mission to kill him in the summer of 1978. And one of the mysteries in the book that I explore is, well, what was their motivation? Were they attempting to assassinate Salameh because he was an armed revolutionary who had carried out operations against Israelis and against Mossad officers, which was all true? Or had they targeted him because they believed he was involved in Munich, which may or may not have been true? Or were they targeting him for assassination because they understood that he was the active back channel to the CIA, and they feared that this would lead to Yasser Arafat standing on the lawn of the White House someday? Well, I think it was actually a combination of all those, but the fact that he was the back channel was a very strong motivating factor.
Well, this has been most interesting. I'm sure these old colleagues of Robert Ames appreciate what you have done here. I find it still kind of unusual. I know the time has gone by, not that much time though. It's such a secret operation as the CIA that we know so much about this particular individual. But thanks to you, Kai Bird. And thank you for this hour with us on Midday.
Thank you, Dan.
Kai Bird, a distinguished author and historian, is a co-author of four previous books, American Prothesis, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, his memoir, The Chairman and the Color of Truth, and this most recent book that we're talking about is published by Crown. It's called The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Well, it's really interesting. So thank you very much, Kai.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our first hour. That's our midday first hour here on Friday. I'm going to take a break now for lunch, provided today by Joe's Squared Pizza. Joe's Square is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood at the Inner Harbor Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. We got the news coming up from NPR at the top of the hour. And then the second hour of our show is all about summer movies. It's Midday on Film with Christopher Reed and Linda DeLibero. They'll be along shortly. So please stay tuned for more Midday coming up in the second hour of our show after the news.